propaganda's had a bit of a bad press over the last few decades, arguably for good reason. But what I'm going to do today is really trace the history of propaganda from its original ancient inceptions through to when really it kind of emerged as a key aspect of warfare in the 20th century, and still to the present day, looking at the ways in which propaganda actually operates, how messages are developed, how the messages are sent out, and how, in many ways, the whole notion of fake news is simply another manifestation of what we would refer to as propaganda. You always know that I like to define things to start off with, and I thought if we actually go way back to the 17th century, that's how propaganda effectively came into our language in Western culture, at least. It was derived primarily from the whole notion of the congregation for propagating the faith. In other words, one of the key aspects of certainly the Christian religion, in many ways most religions, is the whole newly converted zeal, the notion of converting new members to your way of thinking and so on, and propagating the faith and ways of ensuring that more and more people would actually sign up to the religion that possibly maybe was advocating that your God was better than their God and so on, would be very much part and parcel of that whole sequence. And it's interesting, as Fellows remarks in 1959 there, that the whole notion of how we refer to propaganda, a bit like the word gay, which certainly in the 1920s, 1930s meant light-hearted, bubbly, effervescent, energetic personality and so on, has completely changed in terms of its meaning, its format, its ideological notion and its culture. And it's a whole area in which, you know, etymology is a root form in itself. It's the science of the study of words, how words have actually manifested and so on, a really fascinating area. But it's beyond the remit of what we're going to talk about today. However, I just wanted to talk a little bit about how propaganda entered certainly the Western culture and the English language as well. Further definitions, well, let's work from the bottom up here. Let's work up from the notion of one of the negative aspects of propaganda is there isn't any dialogue. This is the definition, there's no argument, there's no statement about this might be the case, this isn't the case, and so on. It's quite simply avoiding any alternative point of view. And if you're actually dealing with wartime propaganda, you might say, absolutely quite right. You don't want to actually be raising the point of view of the enemy. It might make people have sympathy for them, or God forbid, actually be feared about them, and so on and so forth. It's certainly moving up, looks to be a form of communication that actually has its agenda set by the propagandist, the people who are actually writing the propaganda. When you're writing an editorial, when you're writing a column, when you're producing a particular opinion piece, even if it's dealing with being irritated by people walking on the pavement as you're trying to get to university, you've still got a viewpoint that's yours and yours alone. He did write a few things in his time. Mein Kampf, My Struggle, being, of course, the major one. And it's interesting from this perspective how this failed artist, who became one of the world's most notorious dictators, viewed propaganda as a means, and again, judging its success, did it actually secure its objective? It's a slightly circumlocuous way of saying the ends justify the means. And as we'll see in some of the examples I'll be showing you in this session in a few moments, certainly there were areas in terms of pre-war Nazi Germany in which the ends and the means used to justify those ends were really quite interesting. But there is that notion in terms of, you know, once you actually see, that recognise that something is propaganda, it loses its essential magic, because we kind of automatically say that's just propaganda. And we see it for telling untruths and so on. The most dangerous form of propaganda is that which we don't even recognise as being propaganda when we're being exposed to it. Again, we'll go on to talk about that. Again, it's interesting, Goebbels, who was very much the master in terms of the Third Reich organisation, of promoting aspects and viewpoints. We do not talk to say something, but to obtain a certain effect. and you look at the kind of impact with the Nuremberg rallies, and excerpt we'll be seeing shortly from Triumph of the Will, Leni Riefenstahl, and it's the emotion. It's the emotion that carries people along. It's the rhetoric. It's the actual words that are being said that are kind of spoken and uttered from that point of view. And then right at the top there, actually, do we, as far as we know, and I'm not being specious about this, find that dolphins or chimpanzees or sharks or jellyfish actually have their way of actually saying, our field is better than your field? Perhaps they do if you look at the anthropomorphisation of Disney and finding Nemo, genocide in the first few moments. I'm still recovering from that. You know, the shoals of fish killed. But from our perspective, at least, propaganda is something that's unique to human communication, regardless of time, regardless of space, regardless of geographic location. It's actually been with us for a long, long, long time. In fact, it's been with us for as long ago as 522 BC. This is a wonderful example, a 15 meter by 25 meter epic construction, sculpture, relief that's actually seen all about the victories and the background of Darius the Great. How good he is, how wonderful he is, how awesome he is. And just in case you were actually confused and didn't speak the language, it's translated into three different languages, and it's clearly propaganda. It's clearly arguing what a wonderful, fantastic sort of thing this actually is. Where's the difference then between propaganda and advertising, you might well ask, he says, rhetorically. And rightly so, because I'll be going on to consider that. In many ways, things that we take for granted now in the advertising profession, whether it's political, whether it's changing people's views, whether it's going on to what I was talking about last week in terms of public relations, all tie into this whole notion of propaganda. If we were asked to come up with a specific moment where propaganda went from being there and out there and spoken about, etc., to really becoming embedded with respect to a mass medium form, it's highly likely you'd use this invention of the printing press as the key moment in which certainly print was used as a way of spreading messages. And those messages would open up a whole range of things. Luther actually nailed his particular criticisms of the Catholic Church to the door of churches in Germany and Saxony. It was a way of spreading Protestant propaganda throughout Europe in the 16th century. Led to Henry VIII before he actually decided to separate from the Church of Rome, defining himself as Fidei Defensor, being awarded the title of Defender of the Faith, and actually sort of having a counter-argument and so on. And certainly in the terms of the onset of the American Declaration of Independence, Thomas Paine and his Rights of Man and his pamphleteering all produced this whole notion of print culture going out there, because obviously if it's printed, it has to be true. If it's sculpted, it has to be true, does it? And obviously if it's in the newspapers, well, clearly it's true. So, is propaganda always bad? Or are there ways in which sometimes exaggerating the truth or expanding upon areas which you would see as being questionable from a moral or an ethical point of view, could you actually start looking at those kind of areas? Here is a case of where arguably propaganda, whilst ethically highly questionable, was being used to get a message across. A message about abolishing slavery. Wedgwood, you see there, was an abolitionist. One of the things he actually developed was this thing called the Wedgwood Medallion. And again, a bit like Pep Guardiola is being criticised for wearing his little yellow ribbon. Should he? Should he not? Is it a message? Is it propaganda? Is he in sympathy with the Catalonians? Is he in sympathy with the jailed people who are actually there? And so on. But clearly that whole notion of am I not a man and a brother, it opens up that whole notion of getting a message out there. beginning to see people who are in certain sections of society viewed as subhuman as actually being human and just as worthy of individual rights and attention as anybody else in that particular time period and so on. That classic line, you know, a man and a brother. It's obviously patriarchal, but it's still addressing those key areas. Should you then go on to exaggerate some of the conditions that slaves were actually working under? Well, we've also got, by the onset, certainly of the 19th century, the use of photography. And the lines that Stamp actually puts into issue there is that images like this, slave with lots of lashings on his back, has received a whole range of things, etc., referred to as the pornography of pain, it raises that whole question. It's a bit like the shock tactics that are actually often used by animal welfare groups. Other areas where you might think it's not as bad as that, but actually these messages come across. Just jumping slightly further ahead, the reason it took the BBC so long to actually report Belsen and the final solution and the genocide that was taking place in Nazi Germany from 1942 onwards, and they didn't report till the end of the war, was because actually in the First World War they'd been actually criticised very heavily, actually not the BBC, but the media had been criticised very heavily, newsreels and so on, for exaggerating the evils of the Germans, exaggerating to a ridiculous extent. And it was said, no, we don't want to go down that line again, otherwise people will not believe us. So there's like a twofold area in terms of how far do you actually go to get your message out and address it. Do you actually develop that whole notion of having mass media, a story, and finally getting to the stage where what you're looking to impact, in this case the abolitionist movement, is the abolition of slavery, to actually get people thinking very seriously about the fact that something needs to be done and these are things you can actually do to address that issue and so on. It's very difficult when you've got something in society which is so normalised. I mean, again, you could look at contemporary examples with respect to the Me Too movement and so on and so forth. You know, it's always a challenge that we're faced with in terms of how do we relate to each other as human beings and so on, and what messages are being put out to promote that as well. So, we've had the American Civil War, we've had the notion of slavery being made illegal, we've also had the first concentration camps used by the British in South Africa in the Boer War. Great, another successful thing that Britain gave the world, concentration camps. And then in the First World War, of course, we get this whole notion of needing to conscript a large number of troops to go off and fight for their country. Whether that happens to be Uncle Sam in America's later entry into the war, or whether it happens to be Lord Kitchener, a real character, a fictional character. Character who effectively created his own mythologies, a totally mythological image of the United States put together. And again, looking at the lines that is put together in this notion, now it is clearly it's advertising, it's marketing, it's branding the notion of warfare as a way forward. Join your country's army, God save the king. This was the time when the British government began to see the importance of having a Ministry of Information and the Ministry of Wartime Information. And the first writer who effectively worked within that was a gentleman called John Buchan. John Buchan, who went on to actually write 39 Steps and a whole variety of other aspects. And it was seen very much as a case of managing news, managing the news from the front. By this time, not only do we have print, but we also have cinema. We also have basic newsreels, albeit silent, but there are different ways in which media is beginning to be developed. And certainly, if you want to do this well, you want to have good writers developing your narratives. Most of these people you will hopefully have heard of. What has he written?
Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
And also, I think, wrote a really bad science novel that he hoped was better.
Well, very true. But, Thomas Hardy. Tess of the D'Urbervilles, is that Rudyard Kipling. Jungle
Cakes.
Book.
Cakes.
What did you say?
Cakes.
Oh. Yeah. Just need dial back in here. And of course, H.G. Wells, Time Machine, War of the Worlds, and so on. And they would again all be writing books, pamphlets, etc., designed to promote the government's point of view. If you've got pictures being worth a thousand words as well, you can develop a whole range of other sort of areas, etc. Actually, I just found another typo there. No, it's actually in 1918 Beaverbrook became Minister of Information. I thought, I'll double check this after last week's embarrassment. Never mind. Okay, Beaverbrook's line. He was quite explicit as a newspaper owner in terms of what he wanted the Daily Express to develop. He saw it quite simply as a propaganda vehicle for himself to further his own political ambitions. So it was a way of getting his message across to a wider audience. In fact, he's quite clear in terms of a quote that we actually cite up there in terms of what he's looking to develop. But for propaganda to actually work, it's got to reach a mass audience. The more people you can actually reach, the better it will actually be. How do you get that? High circulations, advertising, and so on. And this is one of the clear examples of how owners of the media can often quite unambiguously engage in propaganda to actually promote their own interests and the interests of areas that they believe in and work through. There are some of the images that were being produced at the time of the First World War, so about 100 years or so ago. What do you think this particular image is set up with the strapline there, Daddy? What did you, capital Y-O-U, underline, do in the Great War? Of course, they didn't think it was going to be World War I. It was the war to end all wars. This was the Great War. What is that message being, you know, what message is coming across there? Seems fairly mild in comparison to some of the images we've looked at for the anti-slavery.
Yeah. I seem to remember studying this at school. It was kind of this whole idea, isn't it? That it was kind of implying that, you know, future generations, you know, that there would be that great big question of in the future generations will
rightly
be involved.
Tapping into the guilt factor. Yeah. It's tapping into, here we have a father whose son is playing with some toy soldiers here and looking down there, and war is actually over, and his daughter is obviously learning about the history of the Great War and so on. He's asking her father, most important person arguably in her life, what did he do in the war? So, obviously, you need to have something to say, you need to have a narrative. Really simple but effective. Flip side of course, is what's this all about? Very crude, very basic. What do we actually see there? Destroy this mad brute. What are we seeing here? And avoid actually its potential racist overtones, but you've got this wild jungle monster, this gorilla, wearing the helmet of the Kaiser with a white woman clutched in his dirty, dark hands. With salivary, you know, clearly, you know, how do you actually destroy that? Well, obviously, enlist. It's very crude, it's very basic, but the message is quite unambiguous. And then, on the slightly more sophisticated area, the Committee of Alleged, note the word, alleged German outrages. Report of the Committee of Alleged German Outrages, appointed by Her Majesty's Government, and so on. How close to the truth is this portrayal that we're given? Again, there's a line a few years ago about the Christmas peace where British and German troops effectively played football to celebrate Christmas and then they were immediately taken to different sides and so on and so forth. But inevitably you've got this whole range of things that are being produced regularly in the media. Edith Cavell, very famous nurse, movie that was actually made starring Deborah Carr about the story of Edith Cavell, kind of a latter-day Florence Nightingale, although not working in the Crimean War, working obviously in the First World War. And what do those dreadful Germans actually do? They execute her, and even as the executing party have actually gone away, as they've executed her after a spy for being a spy, après l'exécution, after the execution, they shoot her just to make sure she's actually completely done as well. That's not going to actually make most right-thinking people anything other than quite annoyed. The Daily Mirror. The Lusitania torpedoed by German pirate. giant Cunarder crowded with passengers callously sunk without warning off the Irish coast. Now, clearly, they're designed with the intention of creating a reaction with the audience, a reaction who would actually not necessarily view Germans as being friendly, wonderful folk or fellow human beings we can get along with. Again, you can find so many wonderful words of this, etc. The shot that we've actually got there, you can tell obviously the tin hats, the Kaiser Bill's troops, etc., all portrayed. Pig Liberation Front would actually argue about this, but they're portrayed as actually pigs eating on the entrails again of the European womanhood and so on. Black cat cigarettes, the next to be kicked out, the line from that, and this whole line of the sad experiences of Big and Little Willie during the first 6 months of the Great War. This was a cartoon that was set up, you can see it in the National Cartoon Museum, about two characters, Kaiser Bill and Wilhelm.
Just a quick question. Regards to, talk about that woman, obviously, in that first picture there. Was that supposed to serve as a metaphor for anything? Because in my head, I'm thinking it's almost like a symbolism for like the motherland everyone talks about, like the motherly nature of their own country. Is that what
I think it's more a case of. I mean, remember, this is for us against the Germans. So this is material.
Oh, yeah, yes.
So that's the sort of line that was in all of these instances. This is British propaganda that's used to effectively quite clearly demonise the enemy and to get those messages across in terms of how the enemy's being portrayed and how we actually sort of are sorting it out. In actual fact, of course, we're spending 4 years in a bog. When the Americans arrived, 2 years after the Great War had actually started. Clearly we have our wonderful Edward Bernays back in terms of this. And inevitably, one of the challenges that America is faced with is the same thing as they're faced with in the 1940s. How do they actually persuade the people of America that actually it's worthwhile going all the way across the Atlantic to fight in a war for their former European colony folk and so on and so forth? Well, again, it's the swaying of public opinion. And also providing a whole range of basic, short, biteable speeches, getting people involved by appealing to emotion, appealing to a whole variety of other areas as well. I mentioned a few moments ago that film was very much a whole part of the whole sequence there, and there isn't time today to actually watch all of these, but these slides are actually up online. The links all work. I've double-checked them several times, triple-checked them. Birth of a Nation was the first official motion picture, long-form motion picture that actually entered the general sort of population. It was done by a director called D.W. Griffith. And it's hailed for being a wonderful example of the first motion picture. However, it's also highly criticised for its portrayal of racism and aspects relating to that. And actually, there was a remake a year or so ago, which touched base on this. But the whole essence of what we see in terms of this is basically white propaganda, showing how at the end of the day the whites effectively created America, and it was built on the back of a whole variety of other sort of key aspects, etc. The kindly master of Cameron Hall, Slade, etc. There isn't sufficient time today to work through that. If you want to have a look at it, I'd certainly sort of say by all means do so, but again, it's about 2 to 3 hours long, so worthwhile looking for. And then, of course, in terms of newsreels, we've got this example from the actual Battle of the Somme. Which, I don't know if I actually just pull this out again. Yeah, there we are. Also, all well and good, but a number of these supposed battles and trench warfare and aspects that we're seeing here. Also, there's an argument to say that some of them were staged, some of them were faked, some of them were also... It was a questionable thing. Do you actually show real battles? Do you show real corpses? Does that have a negative effect on the folks back home? Where in war does the extent of truth lie when you start talking about propaganda? You know, a Lancashire battalion, which has been relieved after a successful attack, returns with prisoners. Friend and foe help each other. No! You can't put that out, because you're seeing the Germans no longer as demon warriors. They're actually people who are helping each other in the sheer hell of war. So you've got to start controlling these particular aspects. This, as I say, was not edited. This is stuff which was actually recorded by newsreels at the time with cameras getting that image. It's not a pleasant sight. It's not a sight that we can relate to in terms of saying, you know, it's a mixture of friend and foe. You can tell Tommy saw hats there, the Germans with a slightly different sort of pork pie hats, etc., taking part in this whole side of things. It was actually as a result of this that the government felt they had to develop that propagandist arm, because otherwise the danger was that people would actually start having sympathy for the enemy, a big problem when you're in the midst of wartime activities and so on. So what else is actually happening in terms of this whole sequence that we've actually got there? And there are lots of other examples that have been rescued that you can work through from that point of view. Well, consider Edward Bernays' quote there. It's a fairly long quote, but it's worth considering in terms of the period between the Great War, or World War I, and World War II. And his lines is quite simple. How do you institutionalise propaganda? You manipulate. You manipulate habits and opinions, and again, that's how you control. That's how you effectively organise the country. At its heart, whether it's in wartime or in peacetime, we're all subject to different levels of propaganda. How much do you actually believe what you're being told? How much of it becomes institutionalised? How much are you prepared to accept and settle for the status quo? Or do you actually sort of weigh up all your options and so on? Now, on one level, you can say this is a conspiracy theorist's dream. The manipulation of the unseen mechanism of society, the Bilderberg group, the notions of the Illuminati, a kind of body of people who coordinate everything behind the scenes, for good or indeed ill. But actually, the way the propaganda works in terms of getting those messages across, and I've given a couple of examples, it does kind of impact on our feelings, on our response, and certainly the feelings is what propaganda will play to fairly extensively. Cue the losers of the Great War, or I don't know if it was a loser, well, actually, we signed an armistice, but effectively, they certainly were not the victors, and then mass inflation and the growth of the National Socialism Party, based on the back of Adolf Hitler's My Struggle, Mein Kampf, etc., and the notion of Joseph Goebbels developing this particular aspect of controlling the media. Apparently Goebbels was a big admirer of what Bernays was doing in the States, because he could see the way in which he could control large-scale operations, large-scale elements within that, and he felt we could actually take it a couple of stages further in Germany. So as you can see there, if you wanted to work as a journalist or a writer or an artist in Germany in the period 1928 through 1930s, 40s, etc., you would need to register with one of the Ministry of Public Enlightenment, interesting title, Public Enlightenment and Propaganda, one of the organisations or committees for the press, for fine arts, for music, for theatre, for film, for literature or radio. Every single one of these is a mass media form. Music industry, theatre industry, the film industry, books, print, radio. The only thing that they're actually missing, and it's because they were just developing and exploring this, is television. Okay? And again, if you look at it from the 21st century, you could say social media would be in there as well. But nobody controls that as yet. Or do they? Again, that's another line. And so we get, as a result of that, this whole notion of the manipulation of feelings. Now, Lenin, who was very much at the heart of the Soviet Revolution, together with Joseph Stalin and so on, his quote, which is often wheeled out in defense of the importance of Hollywood and the line that we actually see within that, is of all the arts for us, that being the Soviet cinema, the most important is the cinema. It's interesting that Alexander Nevsky, which was very much an anti-German film, was very popular in 1938. Then it was banned because it was anti-German, and actually there was a suggestion that Stalin and Hitler were agreeing a non-aggression pact. And then, of course, when the Nazis invaded the Soviet, what was then Russia, they effectively relaunched it, and it became used very much as a way of importance for national honour and so on. An equivalent in terms of film industries that was being used in Britain was the Laurence Olivier or Henry V. That was released in colour to, again, act as a morale booster within the 1940s, Our Darkest Hour and so on. That's in addition to a variety of other areas and lines that come through that. But before that, we have this little thing, which is the triumph of the will. 1935, so we're not really approaching war years as yet. And here we have... Feel free to watch the whole thing if you wish, but basically what you've got there is a very solid representation of Germany getting back to its greatness. This was a country that was beaten, that was destroyed, that was effectively on its last legs, that effectively dragged itself up by its bootstraps, and again, triumph of the will develops that whole sort of element of what Riefenstahl is developing. You see a whole range of rallies there and the lines that come together. Flip side, of course, is how do you actually portray the enemy? And here's an example of that as well. Translation: civilized Jews we know in Germany give us but an incomplete picture of their true racial character. This film shows actual shots of the Polish ghettos. It shows us the Jews as they really look, before concealing themselves behind the mask of civilized Europeans. Not very nice at all. But again, reinforcing people's prejudices, reinforcing people's ideals, the notion of Jewish home life reveals a remarkable lack of creative ability to civilize. In plain language, Jewish dwellings are filthy and neglected. Shots of cockroaches and so on there, just to emphasize the whole system. These Jews aren't at all poor. After decades of business, they've hoarded enough to acquire decent, comfortable homes. So it's not the fault of anybody else themselves, but they live for generations in the same dirty and bug-ridden dwellings. Okay, I'm not going to go any further than that because it's real, but as you can see, the clip you can get and watch the whole thing if you wish. But it's clearly portraying a different group of human beings in a way which is hardly favourable. And what do you actually do with cockroaches? What do you do with vermin? What do you do with that once you've demonised folk? Well, you exterminate them, unfortunately. And again, you can see there are lots of sort of areas there which, again, you could say, oh, should we ban that on YouTube? Well, actually, no, because I think people, yeah, it's important to look at what is actually developed. And again, both those links will work through that. But that, as James said, cinema fiction would manipulate emotions, it would manipulate feelings, again, as part of the war effort. Hollywood does exactly the same thing, okay? Don't let it be said that Hollywood was immune to this side of things. This clip from The Great Dictator, very much seen as a spoof on Adolf Hitler and so on, and you can see certainly 1940, is this going to impact on people as well?
Along the mountain.
Brunettes are travel makers, they're worse than the Jews.
Then wipe them out.
You small, not so fast. But get rid of the Jews first, then concentrate on the brunettes.
We shall never have peace until we have a pure Aryan race. How wonderful. Tolmania, a nation of blue-eyed blondes.
We're not a blonde Europe, a blonde Asia, a blonde America.
Blonde world.
And a brunette dictator.
Dictator of the world.
Why not? Not Caesar, Arnulus. The world is in feet, worn out, afraid. No nation would dare to oppose you.
Dictator of the world.
It's your destiny. We'll kill off the Jews, wipe out the brunettes. Then will come forth our dream, a pure Aryan race.
Beautiful blonde Aryans.
They will love you, they will adore you. They will worship you as a god.
No, no, you mustn't say it. You make me afraid of myself.
So clearly there are messages coming across there. It's done in a partial satire. Chaplin himself, of course, the irony being he was booted out of Hollywood because of his alleged communist sympathies in the McCarthy witch hunts as well. But you're clearly getting a message in terms of what's coming together and what sort of is being developed to start developing this whole notion of how people react to what's going on overseas. All again gradually sort of paving the way for, okay, we need to support what's happening in Europe. Although arguably it wasn't until Japan actually entered the war and bombed the Americans at Pearl Harbor that the tide effectively turned. But at all sorts of levels this is actually happening. Even if we actually look at that wonderful organization called Disney. So this is a genius in terms of what you're getting here from Warner Brothers and the Disney organisations aligned from that. But you're clearly getting this whole notion of it's propaganda, certainly. I mean, if you were, you'd probably be sort of a bit annoyed about this, but it's using a different style of getting messages across and addressed to the general public. And lots of layers there. I mean, here's a line there in Russia, a chap, so we're told, it's an object strange to behold. Asked what is his gag, he says, this is the bag the great Adolf will hold. Posters, pamphlets, very much sort of targeting. So you're getting at all levels of society, messages coming across from this point of view. Let's compare that with the one we saw earlier within the British Army, or the British government in terms of what did you do in the war, Daddy? What's the suggestion that we've got here if you happen to volunteer for submarine service in the United States? The women will love you, you'll get the girl, all be wonderful, you'll be a hero. Pushing that hero side of things from that point of view. And again, you're looking at how things are being developed and put forward, as indeed are these characters who still resonate today. You may have heard of two or three of them. That's about the Submariner. But certainly, you know, that whole line of bashing Adolf, taking on board the Nazi, you've almost got pretty much the same pose there from Superman, from Captain America, and so on, and obviously the Submariner, Prince Namor, effectively smashing the subs and so on. Shazam, Captain Marvel, the original Captain Marvel, again, teaming up with Bullet Man to actually take on board the world enemy number one, Captain Nazi. Okay? So it's quite clear in terms of the messages that are coming through, and obviously such resonance that, you know, Marvel empires, you can go to Euro Disney now and actually become a superhero. Wow, that's great. But there's all kinds of propaganda now on one level. You think, well, this is culture, this is entertainment, this is great, but also it's sending messages. It's using all of those channels of communication to start addressing areas and aspects that are kind of opening up for consumption. Radio as well is really emerging in the 1930s and 1940s. Even William Joyce, who was executed after the war as being a traitor, who would speak in English on behalf of Germany and effectively just let the listener know how well Germany was actually doing. Originally, there was a thought that they should actually jam the transmissions. But then they actually, the government at the time felt, okay, well, they'll leave it open just on the basis of showing how ridiculous it sounds. This particular aspect in 1938 was when Orson Welles did a dramatised radio version of H.G. Wells, no relation, version of War of the Worlds, and it created mass panic on the eastern coasts of America because people genuinely believed that the Martians were landing. Franklin D. Roosevelt, President of the United States, pioneered what we now almost see as the State of the Nation, the tweet, etc., the fireside chat every Sunday. He would effectively spend 10-15 minutes broadcasting to the nation from allegedly his fireside, etc. And certainly Hitler himself was keen to actually use radio, although it was often seen that Hitler was much more of a visual person. His Nuremberg rallies, Triumph of the Will, and so on were very much visual counterparts to the medium of radio. But the power of a good voice, the power of a rhetoric, can certainly actually develop and improve things. So let's move to the latter part of the 20th century. Let's look at some of the other areas which were actually happening after World War II, because propaganda doesn't just say, well, we've won the war, let's put all our propaganda toys in the box now and let's avoid it completely. No, you have the Cold War. You have the battle between ideologies, communism and capitalism. You have the whole notion there, a very dramatic poster, is this tomorrow? The Stars and the Stripes being burnt whilst good Americans are being slaughtered by Reds under the beds, America under communism. A whole notion of Rocky Balboa developed his whole sort of system, the best of Irish. Yeah, all of these kind of areas are developed in terms of how we perceive the enemy, how terrorists are perceived. It's the old line that history is often rewritten by the victors. Are today's terrorists tomorrow's freedom fighters? How do you actually manage to develop some kind of truth? Do you actually consistently demonise, whether you're dealing with Al-Qaeda, Taliban, other sort of areas? How do we actually sort of cope with the address of that? In other words, as we actually have entered the 21st century, more than that actually, is it a case of the instant image, the propaganda that comes across through the social challenges of communication and so on, or do we actually get to the whole sort of line of, you know, again, same sort of emotion, this product is awesome, damned lies and so on. Here are some examples taken from the last few years. The Daily Express, now longer under Beaverbrook. It's interesting, didn't we heard what name change Trinity Mirror have decided to actually change their company title to? News, no Press Gazette people here? Breaking news, Trinity Mirror have just taken over the Gazette, the Express, as well as the Daily Star, and of course they're on the Daily Mirror. They're no longer going to be called...
Yes,
what is it, are they going to be called?
I don't know what they wanted to call it. All I read was that they said that they were just still going to make it a right-wing paper. They weren't going to change it up.
Yes, but they've changed the name of their company.
Right.
It's called Reach.
Reach.
Reach. R-E-A-C-H. Reach, like S Club 7. Reach for the stars. But in terms of, that's the sort of brand. So again, branding, changing the name, the whole thing. Trinity Mirror, no more. Change the name to Reach. This is an example of, obviously, the Express to cyber warfare. Putin, obviously the Russian leader, launches propaganda campaign against Britain, officials claim. So we're still seeing propaganda in that sense of being, well, we use the term cyber warfare, but disinformation. How messages are coming across on that basis. The Independent, or the I, this was when it was, the Independent was a print sort of thing. ISIS is winning the digital propaganda war. How are you actually getting your messages across on that basis? Again, Jane's very in there for comparative media history. Sector-specific definitions have become eroded by technology and cross-media ownership. So you've got very much a blurring of the boundaries, much more so than you had back in the days of the Gutenberg press, where things actually operated on that basis. And the BBC's very own statement on the whole system. With its own radio station, magazines in a range of languages, and a daily flow of video and photo reports, the jihadist group Islamic State runs a professional media operation that seeks to bolster its claim to be a fully functioning state. Now, again, it's arguable how much truth these things connect with us. But if we just sort of hop back, let's just go right here to another one of these little cartoons. If you actually had an Islamic sort of situation. Same one for some bizarre reason. I thought I'd give you a second one. No, obviously I had. Never mind. Bottom line, propaganda. I started off with two particular sort of quotes here. One was Goebbels in propaganda, as in love, anything is permissible which is successful. And then the BBC handbooks, no permanent propaganda policy can in the modern world be based on untruthfulness. Ultimately, as individual citizens, you make the decision in terms of what is propaganda, what isn't propaganda. What I've endeavoured to do over the last few moments is give you some indications in terms of the history of propaganda, but also how it's been used, almost so it becomes invisible. Remember that line that propaganda fails when we recognise it as propaganda, because suddenly we start acknowledging that sort of system. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that everything is propaganda, it does mean maybe you need to be a bit more discerning in determining what is and is not biased in one clear way in favour of one particular side or the other. Any questions? Any general thoughts? Anything that you've learned which you decided? I don't think I should ask this question, which I always like to do. What have you learned today that you didn't know before? So let's start off with. Yeah, I mean, the Vatican has its own radio station, it has its own press network, so does the Church of England, so do all sorts of, I mean, it's one of the reasons in terms of responding institutionally to areas, whether it be paedophilia or any sort of aspects, you've got these whole aspects that come across with that. So does the royal family, the corporation of that is such that, it's interesting in terms of the management. Meghan Markle, the first thing that she's, one of the first things she's had to do since tying the engagement ring and all the rest of the bits and pieces, was to suspend her Twitter account. Because you want to make sure that things are deemed appropriate, anything that goes out into the public domain is sorted through. And it's managing. And actually the royal family is a really good example in latter years of how it's really managed the whole thing effectively.
Realise that propaganda is so in so much Disney and Doctor
Why do you think that was? Why do you think that we have this whole range of Disney, Warner Brothers, and indeed Hollywood itself? Why did we actually sort of get, you know, Casablanca? This would be the start of a beautiful friendship. Sort of play it again for me, Sam. Why? Why? Absolutely. Did anybody see the Academy Awards? Or see any of the sort of lines on it? Did anybody see the Frances McDormand stand up, of your woman stand up? So, yeah, I mean, these are messages. These are important. As human beings, we really respond in many ways to symbols, to signs, to mass media forms. Things can be normalised to such an extent that we always expect a patriarchal society to be the case. Well, maybe not. Maybe you do change things around. Maybe you actually, you know, maybe slavery, which was very much the business as normal, actually, no. You know, there are ways here in which you need to look at other various other ideologies and so on. So clearly, Hollywood, which in itself is a dream factory by its own description, it's making people's dreams. Therefore, it's engaging in the potential manipulation of those dreams. So why not actually sort of use those to put out positive messages? Or do you just change the ideologies around? Or if you're being totally cynical, would you say, well, you know, Reef and Star, unfortunately, her career kind of tanked because she was too closely associated with the Nazi Party?
Yeah, I was just
going to
say what
Anne
was going to say. I think that
yeah, I mean, it's interesting that in the advent of 9/11, Hollywood almost voluntarily decided to suspend disaster movies because they felt it was too reminiscent of the Trade Tower disaster, etc. And there's a Marvel comic at the time of Spider-Man in which he's literally just portrayed looking at the devastation of the Twin Towers and saying some things even beyond a superhero to actually solve and so on. I think because of the culture, contemporary culture, and you can't actually get much more contemporary in certain ways than graphic narratives or sequential storytelling. You know, they've embedded ourselves in, it's been embedded themselves in huge aspects of our culture. And they are kind of taking messages and working through that. Wonder Woman, I didn't actually put a slide up there, but obviously she emerged in the Second World War, and again has been reinvented for our own times as kind of Patty Jenkins directed film, female empowerment and so on, developing that. So, you know, that kind of reflection of cultures and art reflecting reality, that comes together.
Sorry?
500 BC. Oh yes, way back.
First came about in like the 1900s.
Now what we have seen in terms of that huge explosion of examples of propaganda over the last century has really been the result of a combination, which is really absolutely connected with this module, of different media forms. Radio, print, television, film, and social media. You know, in 2 weeks' time, I'll be talking about transmedia storytelling and how different forms appear in different forms, and it's something we almost take for granted now. But that's certainly one of the ways where it's become a lot easier for people to actually say, that's just propaganda, that is, without actually realising that maybe you just need to think a little bit more about where that propaganda is coming from and what messages are coming through. You know, on the one hand, we can all turn around and say Fox News is very right-wing. But what about series on Fox television that effectively maybe have a right-wing agenda, that kind of their messages come through in CSI programs, in NCIS programs, and various other messages? Or maybe, again, you might have more sympathy with that viewpoint. It's all about getting your message out there to the widest possible audience. What Goebbels and the Third Reich. I mean, it's interesting, and if you read the chapter on War and Beyond, chapter 6, there's a lot of exploration, and Jane actually touches on this, about how in the latter years of the war, as far as Germany was concerned, they sought more and more to control the messages that were coming out there, but actually the German public had kind of recognised by that stage, or some members had, that even though they were faced with imprisonment for watching transmissions from the enemy and so on, they'd be listening to BBC News, they knew that effectively they weren't succeeding. You know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but not all the people all the time. And if you're constantly using propaganda to tell lies, that was at the heart of what I talked about last week with Lee's statement, that ultimately, if constantly you're telling lie after lie... I mean, the thing about The Great Dictator is actually Chaplin was partly satirising, but also what he was saying, I mean, admittedly, blondes, good, brunettes, not, and then he brought in the Jews and so on, various other sort of aspects. But the message was actually clearly there. It was clearly, you know, in the short clip that we actually saw, it was very much looking at how this challenge was being portrayed and how we were going to react to that whole side of things. Now, of course, there is the reverse of the whole thing. The people would say, as I say, conspiracy theory, oh, well, what would you expect from Hollywood? They're run by Jews. Don't think so. You'll find there are all sorts of other combination factors which are actually within that. And Hollywood itself was very much subject to the Hays Code, which effectively sort of meant you had very strict religious guidelines set up by the church in terms of what was permissible, what wasn't permissible, what you could see and what you couldn't see. Yes?
I didn't realise that, say for example, The Great Dictator was put out during the war.
Well, bear in mind it was during our war in Europe. It's 2 years before the Americans actually entered into the situation. But it was part of the package of gradually, some might say, softening up the Americans. It could well be that it was a case of, no, it needed Pearl Harbor for them to actually take that move, to actually provide the support and so on. And again, that whole notion of Casablanca, sort of notion of what we're seeing there, that package of the way that sort of the industry produces stuff and so on.
It might come across as a bit surprising, but I didn't really have a great understanding of what propaganda meant. I mean, I know that sounds a bit weird and bizarre, but I mean, in the sense that previously I've had a kind of presumption of what it meant. And, you know, if somebody said, oh, that was propaganda, I'd had an idea. So I got a bit more of an insight into its more exact definition.
Well, it's focus. So, I mean, as with all language, it changes its meaning, adjusts on all sorts of other basics. But I think from that point of view, it hopefully sort of sets the scene for your own pieces of propaganda presentations, of which we have two coming up in a few seconds. So, as I said, all the slides are actually online, so you can download those. Look at them. I mean, I would encourage you to look at the film clips I put up there in detail, etc. You'll find the whole range of sort of elements that come through within that. Again, pursue it at your leisure. Thanks for your time, and I look forward to being entertained for the next hour. Next week will be the history of television. So, trailer heads to that. The thing which we might actually have stopped watching these days.